Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back on Monday. An Islamic militant group takes responsibility for two bomb attacks yesterday that killed more than 27 people in southeastern Iran. And the Afghan government reluctantly backs a U.S. security plan. Joining me to discuss these and other top international stories of the week, David Ignatius, a columnist with The Washington Post and co-moderator of Post Global on WashingtonPost.com. Nadia Bilbasi, she's the senior U.S. correspondent for MBC TV, Middle East Broadcast Center. And Yoki Driessen, he joins us for the first time in his new role as senior national security correspondent for National Journal Magazine. Congratulations, Yoki.
Thanks very much.
And welcome to everyone to this hour of the Diane Rehm Show. We invite our listeners to join our conversation. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org, or you can find us on Twitter or Facebook. Well, let's start by talking about the situation in Afghanistan, this new agreement, David, between the U.S. and the Karzai government. What is the agreement about?
The agreement provides for the creation or expansion, really, of local armed groups in Afghanistan that you might say are bottom-up militia units. The agreement calls for calling them local police and putting them in uniforms. I think this is important in part because it's the first political win for General Petraeus since he became commander in Afghanistan. This is a program the U.S. has been pushing in fits and starts for the last several years, but it's been opposed by President Karzai, who fears challenge to his top-down authority, to the Afghan National Army and Afghan National Police, by groups that could become militias and, he says, could bring back warlordism. General Petraeus has felt very strongly that, as in Iraq, where working with local Sunni militias that became known as the Awakening is a key part of getting bottom-up resistance to the Taliban adversary, that we need to do something very similar in Afghanistan. There was political blockage in Kabul at the top from the Karzai government. There were reports that Karzai was absolutely refusing to do this, and it's clear that Petraeus ended up winning that fight. So it's an important political gain for him.
I think the only difference as well is here when you look at the forces, they, unlike in Iraq and the General Petraeus' idea of including the Sunni Awakening Council, we have people are drawn from outside the insurgents, unlike in the situation in Iraq, and therefore we're going to have probably too many people applied for this job. We're talking about 10,000. The number has been varied. Some saying 100,000. The Afghan government said maybe it's 10,000 or under. So we will see the success of this project, but I think it will be General Petraeus doing wonder. There is areas in remote parts of Afghanistan that has absolutely no police control whatsoever. So what they wanted to do is to have a light armed force filling in the gap to make sure that the Taliban is not coming to this area. And they're selling them as kind of like a community awareness or people who are interested in keeping the security and the safety of their own people as opposed to a militia. And the word militia is a very bad word in Afghan history. And it reminds us again of what happened after the withdrawal of the Soviet Union. And the fragmentation of the army into the formation, rather, of militias that fought against each other and led to a very nasty civil war. Unlike this, and I think just one final point here is, unlike in Iraq, where you have very strong army, the Iraqi army was 400,000 soldiers, and they were very strong. The hard battle, because they fought against Iran for 8 years. Now you have an Afghan army that obviously not nowhere near the degree that the Americans want them to be in terms of training. And if you remember the previous administration, they always said our withdrawal in Iraq always hinged on one point: when they step up, when we step down. And that's, I think, the situation is going to be in Afghanistan.
Yoki, do you think it's realistic to model this effort in Afghanistan on what turned out to be a great success in Iraq with the Awakening?
Clearly the hope. I mean, if we're talking about the elephant in the room in this whole discussion, and frankly hanging over the whole discussion about General Petraeus going to Afghanistan, it was, can he do in Afghanistan what he did in Iraq? I mean, that is the only question, really, that is it sort of matters on the macro level. This is something that he and General Rierno pioneered that worked. Afghanistan, though, as we're reminded again and again and again, is not Iraq. I mean, it's worth remembering that General Dan McNeil, who was three generals ago now in Afghanistan, tried the same idea. There's a tradition in Afghanistan of what are called Arbakai, who are Pashtun militias that are sort of informally organized whenever there's an external threat. General McNeil was talking 5 years ago about creating Arbakai in the Pashtun areas. It didn't go anywhere. It's also worth remembering David's point earlier about how the Karzai government opposed this. He wasn't the only one who opposed this. Retired general, current ambassador Carl Eikenberry also opposed this and had worked very hard to try to block funding. Part of the fights that hung over General McChrystal were with the embassy and with Eikenberry in particular. What this shows for Petraeus is whether it works kind of on the battlefield is one thing, but what we do see now is that Petraeus goes to Afghanistan not as someone who will be fighting with Carl Eikenberry the way McChrystal did, but as someone who is very clearly the top person, and that fight at least has been settled with Petraeus on top.
David?
Yes, I think another important feature of this is that it will be driven by U.S. Special Operations Forces. The idea was where you see a tribe or a community that wants to stand up to the Taliban but doesn't have the resources, you send in special forces A-teams to work with the local tribal leadership. There was a program to try to push this in one province, Wardak province, that was called the Afghan Public Protection Force, using our soft troops, which are really our best troops. Petraeus loves this stuff. This is the kind of warfare that he, as a ranger who's worked with special forces through his career, really thinks works. So it gives some momentum to a kind of tactic, again, bottom up, not top down, that some people think is our best shot in the remaining time we have.
But, you know, this comes at a time when Americans are increasingly alarmed about these rising casualty figures out of Iraq. This is on track to be the deadliest year since 2001 for U.S. forces in Iraq. 2,000 Americans wounded through July 3rd. That's just about as many as were wounded throughout 2009. In Afghanistan, yes. And so is that part of this effort that we're going to be living with more U.S. casualties?
Well, it's going to be more U.S. casualties because the more they step the fight against the Taliban, the more you're going to have casualties. And what we have seen recently, which is on this month alone, I think, is 43 soldiers dead among NATO. 33 of them are Americans. So the number is increasingly high. Again, the Taliban, after they've been pushed out of Mersa, and now they want to show the other force to be on the ground, and they wanted to show that actually they are there and they fight in the Americans. So the number is going to be high, and I think that's partly probably one of the reasons to find out if we can bring the soldiers or the U.S. forces or the NATO forces to fight with the Taliban and leave the other areas to this so-called local defense, whatever you want to call them, militias or armed men or whatever. But I think just one quick point regarding that is General Petraeus decided what to put these forces under the control of the Ministry of Interior, which is important because it gives President Karzai some kind of control over them, and they will be their paymaster. So the loyalty somehow is going to be back to the central government as opposed to be the tribal thing. But that's obviously remain to be seen if it's going to happen or not.
Yogi?
There's a blizzard of spin coming out of Afghanistan right now. I mean, it reminds me of the worst days of the Iraq debate prior to the Bush decision, before the surge. The disconnect, I mean, the Rolling Stone article was in some ways the starkest reflection of it, but the disconnect between official Washington and what you hear when you're in Afghanistan, talk to people on the ground in Afghanistan, it's a very stark divide. The program in Wardak that David mentioned hasn't worked. I mean, that program is more than 2 years old. I wrote about it 2 years ago when it was first getting off the ground. If you ask people in the Pentagon to assess it, the most optimistic assessment you get is it's mixed. But no one says it's a success. This issue of casualties rising because you're taking the fight to the Taliban, that's McChrystal's characterization, that is Petraeus's characterization. But unfortunately, it's not as if we're pushing them out in any measurable way. Marja has been, again, at best mixed and at worst a failure. The governor we appointed of Marja was replaced. Reconstruction has not taken place there at all. Security in Marja is terrible. Security in Kandahar is terrible. So the idea that casualties are rising, but, and the but being, we're taking the fight to the Taliban, we're reclaiming territory, we're having all these battlefield successes, it's very hard to point to any battlefield successes right now on the ground in Afghanistan, which is very depressing.
You're saying casualties are rising, but what? What do you think the real situation is?
I think casualties are rising because the Taliban and their allies, the Haqqani group and some of the other groups that fight alongside them, have gotten much better. I did a story a couple of months ago about the fact that in Afghanistan, IEDs, which are the number one killer there as they were in Iraq, it's not that they're technologically sophisticated. In Iraq, it was a sort of ever more advanced bomb. In Afghanistan, the bombs are just enormous, 1,000 pounds, 2,000 pounds. They've gotten more tactically proficient, so they'll, you know, have an ambush that starts with a bomb on one side of the road, snipers on the other side, other guys with guns waiting for the responders to come. So the attacks have gotten more sophisticated, the bombs have gotten bigger, and casualties are rising as a result.
Nadia.
And also, this point has been raised in the Senate the last few days, and you have seen the grueling attack that Envoy Holbrooke came under from even the Democrat lawmakers of saying what exactly our strategy in Afghanistan, what is victory. You know, describe to us, you've been talking for 1 hour, but we haven't heard anything new about the success. And also we hear that now when they appointed General Petraeus to replace General McChrystal, the talk was nothing changed. It's only personality. It's only the name, but the strategy is the same. The counterinsurgency is the same. Everybody agreeing. You hear it from the White House, you hear it from the Pentagon. But the problem is, if using the same strategy and they're expecting different results, I don't know how this is going to work. The math doesn't add up here.
And David, I wonder what that says about the idea that U.S. forces will begin to withdraw next year, which is one reason I think support for the war hasn't dropped further than it has in the United States.
President Obama, when he announces his strategy for Afghanistan last November, was very clear that he was going to begin withdrawing the forces that he was adding in July 2011. And that timetable has been the most controversial aspect of his program. It's clear that the White House is sticking to that, and President Obama and General Petraeus and everybody else keep repeating that deadline is real. What I think it means inevitably is that there's a window of 12 to 18 months, let's say, in which to try to get an end state that's acceptable, not, you couldn't call it victory, but acceptable. And we'll see whether these new efforts are going to lead in that direction.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the situation in Iraq, and we'll go to the phones, take some of your calls. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm, and we're joined in the studio by Yoki Driesen, Senior National Security Correspondent for National Journal Magazine, Nadia Bilbassi, she's Senior U.S. Correspondent for NBC-TV, the Middle East Broadcast Center, and David Ignatius, he's a columnist with the Washington Post. And in fact, David, in your column this morning, you have some news, it seems to me, about that Russian spy swap. Tell us what you found.
Well, I found out that the four Russians who were swapped back to the U.S. As part of the exchange where this notorious illegal spy ring that had been operating with the glamorous Anna Chapman as one of the Russian illegals, the four who came our way included two who were named Zaporosky and Vasilyenko, who, according to my U.S. government sources, are really important spies, who, in fact, are the key to our ability, finally, to identify Aldrich Ames as a Soviet mole within the CIA and Robert Hansen as a similar penetration of the FBI. These guys operating at enormous risk in Moscow, going through the most secret KGB files, were able finally to pin down the identifications. I note that it's possible that one of them may actually have looked at, examined the fingerprints on documents that have been sent by Hansen to Moscow. They didn't have Hansen's real name, remember, in that case, which made identification of him so difficult, and they got fingerprints, which they were then able to get back to the U.S., analyze. So a lot of what you've heard and read about how we nailed Hansen and Ames, including a very prominent movie about Hansen, is in part a cover story. The real action, I'm told, happened in Moscow, not here in Washington, not in the FBI's sleuthing.
Now, you write that you knew something about this a couple years ago, but it was off the record.
I was, as like many people covering stories, I heard a whisper of this and was told specifically, this is off the record, meaning this is not for any use. And journalists try to honor those ground rules as others. When the spy swap happened, I called an official who I thought would be knowledgeable, and I said, are you prepared to remove the embargo now? The Russians obviously know, and now that these people are out, isn't it time that this story can be told? And the decision was yes, so it's in the paper this morning.
Does that mean that we truly have entered a different era in U.S.-Russia relations where this seems quite old school, seems quite distant, this kind of spy versus spy? Or is that still part of U.S.-Russian relations now?
I would imagine that it'll be part of U.S.-Russian relations for a very long time to come, whether it's corporate espionage, whether it's actual espionage. I mean, reading David's column, which I thought was fascinating, we were talking about this, all of us, before we went on air, but this story has been covered in the U.S. I mean, it's been mocked for the most part. It's been sort of a source of comedy since the initial arrest of these 10, you know, the hot redhead, the sort of bumbling people with living on the Russian dime in the suburbs and not sending back anything of value. But the fact that, as David points out in his column, these two spies that the U.S. took back were themselves so valuable, it just makes me wonder, and I don't know the answer to it, but whether these 10 Russians may have perhaps been more valuable and not the kind of bumbling, comedic fools that they've been portrayed to be.
That's such an interesting point, because as you're pointing out, sometimes lots of time has to pass before we know
exactly
what's a cover story and what's the truth.
Or it could be a new way that the Soviet Union during the Cold War, now with Russia looking at different way of dealing with the U.S. and they were willing to extradite, to exchange people that, as you said, they were made of as a comedy stock on TV to a serious spy, as David just said. So we don't know which one. It could be either case, actually.
You know, while we're talking about this general area, let's talk about this odd situation with Iran, where we had somebody, a scientist, who was either a defector or somebody who was kidnapped. What's going on with this one, David?
Well, obviously we can't be 100% certain, but my sources say that he was initially a willing defector, that he had been in touch with the U.S. for some time. By the U.S., I mean the CIA, for some time before he was smuggled out during a pilgrimage to Saudi Arabia in June of last year, that he provided valuable information about the Iranian nuclear program. He was not a key person in it, but he was a nuclear scientist on the periphery. Like many defectors, during the course of his time in the U.S., it's clear that he became lonely, depressed, anxious, guilty. All you have to do is watch the videos of him that were posted on YouTube, and you see a young man in some anguish. I'm sure the Iranians were putting a lot of pressure. He was getting communications from his wife and son he'd left behind. And finally, that pressure just became so enormous he wanted to go home.
And
he did.
It's such a great world that we can look at the spy story on YouTube and try to assess the motives of this Iranian. He was greeted as a hero when he landed in Tehran. Not so clear today whether that hero status is going to sustain.
Oh, absolutely. And it reminds us all of the story that happened in Iraq before. If you remember, Saddam Hussein's son-in-law was in Amman, and he actually divulged some information about so-called Iraq secret program, and then he enticed him to come back, and he was the husband of his daughter. Two of them, actually. And when they came back, they welcomed them as the hero, but then a few days later, they were executed. Now, we don't know what's happening to Amiri in this case, but it's such a mysterious story. I think it will be fitting for David to write a novel about it from all kind of elements, actually. But definitely, the Iranian government is using it now as a propaganda tool for them, that he is not jeopardizing their national interest, that he actually refused the $50 million that the CIA offered him, and he actually insisted that that he was kidnapped, he was drugged, he was brought from Medina mysteriously to the United States, and then he showed up again mysteriously at the intersection of the Pakistani embassy here in Wisconsin Avenue, but not very far from here, actually. So it is a very bizarre story, and it just gives us a little bit of a glimpse in the espionage world, and also it tells us a little bit about that the Americans, since they cut off relationship, diplomatic relations with Iran, that they don't have anybody on the ground. So the fact that you can get anyone to give you a little bit of human information through an agent, it will be very valuable for them. But again, we don't know. He's 32-year-old. He's not a top scientist. We don't know how much information he has, although some sources indicated that he did give some important information to the CIA.
You know, quite seriously, in Iran, Yoki, we heard about two bomb attacks in southeastern Iran yesterday. At least 27 people killed. What do we know about this attack?
The responsibility was claimed by a Sunni group that has carried out attacks in the past and whose leader had been captured and ultimately executed by the Iranian government some time ago. And they said that this was explicitly retaliation for that capture and ultimately, the execution of their leader. But it's interesting because we know so little in this country about what's happening on the ground in Iran. Politically, we know so little about what's happening culturally. I mean, there are books periodically, but it remains in many ways a closed society to us. And there are bombings and other attacks that take place on the periphery of Iran somewhat regularly. The Iranian government will often say that they're carried out by British agents or Israeli agents or U.S. agents, but there's a cauldron of tensions within Iran that are often confusing to us on the outside. You know, Sunni, as in this case, Sunni tensions with the Shia government, other minority groups in tension with the Shia government. It's just a reminder in some ways, Nadia's point earlier, of how little we know actually about what's taking place in this pivotal and very, very fascinating country.
And I wonder when the Iranian government says this is a great victory, that this guy came home, he was drugged and kidnapped, he didn't tell anything of value, he rejected U.S. efforts to get him to tell secrets. Do the Iranian people, do you think, accept that, believe that? Does that make a case with them?
In my experience, both when I visited Iran in 2006 and talking to Iranians since, Iranians are pretty smart and cynical about everything, and they'll be looking at this and rolling their eyes. I think, Amiri's best life insurance policy is the fact that initially, at least, the Iranians seemed to buy into his story that he'd been kidnapped and tortured by the terrible Americans, so they kind of got to stick to that. On the question we were discussing a moment ago, that Yoki was talking about this bombing in southeastern mm-hmm. Iran, we forget that Iran, like so many nations in that part of the world, is stitched together with very different nationalities. In that part of Iran where the bombing took place, there's a large Baluch ethnic community, and there's always been a Baluch liberation movement on both sides of the border in Iran and Pakistan. That's a danger for Iran. You have Azeri nationalists in the northwest of the country. You have Kurds who want to be part of Kurdistan. You have Iranian Arabs in the southwest who Saddam was always trying to get to break away. A big question for the U.S. has been whether to try to play this nationalities card. It's something the Israeli government has long thought as a point of vulnerability, and they'd love to see more action on this front. The U.S. in recent years has held back, thinking the last thing we need in this part of the world is another fragmented nation blowing up into its different pieces. But that's part of the problem that the leadership in Iran has to worry about.
Our phone lines are open. Let's go to the phones and let some of our listeners join this conversation. If you want to call us, our number 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. We'll go first to Thomasina calling us from Ormond Beach, Florida. Good morning.
Good morning. The training of Afghanistan soldiers, I wonder what makes this agreement different from the one our military had early on in Iraq. Our military leaders failed for years to encourage Iraqis to fight against other Iraqis, and from reports that I had read back then, our training of the Iraqis was slow and inadequate. Throw in the fact that Karzai is corrupt and probably cannot be trusted. What makes this new agreement with Afghanistan different or better?
All right. Thanks very much for your call, Thomasina.
Well, actually, I think the program in Iraq was a success, that General Petraeus managed to get Sunni group that allied themselves at the time with al-Qaeda to reverse 180 degrees and to fight al-Qaeda. The Iraqi army is doing a good job by UN standard, by observer standard, to the degree that the foreign minister, Hushair Zebari, who was in town the other day when he was asked about the U.S. troops withdrawing as agreed by the end of August, beginning of September of this year, or at least they can withdraw to leave amount to 50,000. Were they worried? And he said, not at all. Actually, the Iraqi army is able to control the security. Not to say that everything is going to be fine in Iraq, obviously not. But the comparison does not really hold at all. As I said before, the Iraqi army was very well trained during Saddam. It was the strongest army, although they defected, but they were drawn now from a different kind of background, mainly really Shiite. But they are able to do a good job. And there was testified during the election as well. During the election, all the security that was carried out throughout Iraq was carried by the security forces of Iraq. Unlike in Afghanistan, which is it's a completely different story, and I don't see, who knows? I mean, we have to wait and see what's going to happen in Afghanistan. But the bottom line is it's a very, very tough job to train these people, and especially in a remote area. We're talking about the size, the geography, the culture, the tribal division, the corrupt government in Kabul. There's so many elements that can make this program very difficult to realize.
Yogi.
I think in the question, though, she was inadvertently confusing two different things. There was the one program that is training the actual official Afghan National Army, the actual official Iraqi Army, which is a separate program entirely from what we've been discussing so far today, which is a much looser, much more informal idea of basically providing minimal oversight, weapons and uniforms to tribesmen. It's different programs entirely.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Well, while we're touching on Iraq, let's talk about this transfer that we saw this week, David, of the last prison that the United States was managing in Iraq. Is this an important step, do you think?
It certainly is important symbolically. This was Camp Cropper out by the Baghdad airport, where some of the most notorious prisoners, including while he was alive, Saddam Hussein, were held. The remaining prisoners there include Tariq Aziz, the former deputy prime minister and foreign minister. The fact that these prisoners and prisons are going over to Iraqi control fully now is a sign of Iraqi sovereignty being reestablished strongly. There'll be lots of other signs, big bases the U.S. occupies, full control of the airport, a whole series of things, so that Iraq really will look Iraqi once again. Will it hold together? Will the Iraqis do a good job? As we saw at Abu Ghraib, managing prisoners is a very, very difficult problem, and it's so easy to have abuse. How will the Iraqis do running this? I think everybody will watch, including human rights monitors.
Since this establishment of 2003, there's about 90,000 prisoners went in and out of this jail. And as David said, of course, the most notorious was Saddam Hussein, who stayed there. The lawyer for Tariq Aziz, who was the former foreign minister, actually spoke yesterday from Amman, and he was worried that actually that Tariq Aziz is going to be handed over to the Iraqi, and he warned that he's going to be killed even. So the problem here, it is an important step. I mean, the Pentagon described it as a milestone of giving sovereignty to the Iraqis, etc. But also at the same time, they keep in out of these prisoners, who I think about 1,500, 200, they're giving them to the Americans, and they wanted the Americans to keep an eye on them. They held in some kind of supermax jail, and most of them are former regime members, about 8 of them, I think. There is al-Qaeda members there. So I think the security for these people is so high that they cannot handle, and they wanted the Americans to keep an eye on them. And I think this is an important step. But at the same time, we don't see this number of people. Whenever they are suspicious of a person on the street, they can collect them en masse and put them in jail. The only problem is, as David said, neither the Americans nor the Iraqis have a good reputation when it comes to jails. We know about Abu Ghraib, and we know about the Shiite militias that was linked directly to the prime minister in terms of maltreatment of prisoners. But the human rights minister in Iraq said that actually, no, this is not the case, and we'll be able to handle it. And this is a very important step forward in terms of gaining full sovereignty.
Okay, these 200 prisoners that the Iraqis have asked the U.S. to maintain control of, Tell us more about who they are and where are they kept? And will we be keeping them forever? What's the prospect with this particular group of prisoners?
You know, that last question is probably the trickiest. I mean, in some ways, this is analogous to the prisoners you have, the remaining prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. I mean, these are people who are either directly responsible for mass casualty bombings or who had been in the leadership of al-Qaeda in Iraq when it was at its peak, or in some cases are political prisoners of very high sensitivity. But it's a very tricky question. And there's a little bit less than meets the eye here. I mean, this is a milestone. And again, the military, which likes to tout good news, is touting it as such. But many Iraqis, my last translator in Baghdad is now visiting and is Sunni. He has cousins who have been arrested. And we were talking about this a couple of nights ago over dinner. But there are many Iraqis who would much prefer to have been imprisoned by the U.S. than imprisoned by the Iraqis. Under the U.S., there was a system for visiting. There was a system for getting letters. It was imperfect. It had flaws. But generally speaking, Iraqis felt comfortable that they knew where their loved ones were and had access to them. There is much less comfort with how Iraqis, particularly Sunni, will be treated. There have been torture scandals. There have been prisoners beaten to death. Whether the Iraqis are up to this isn't just an open question. It's in many ways a question that potentially shadows what is otherwise a bit of good news.
Yoki Driessen, he's with National Journal. And we're also joined this hour by Nadia Bilbassi from Middle East Broadcast Center and David Ignatius from The Washington Post. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the six-month anniversary of that terrible earthquake in Haiti and how things are going there. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Harvey Pekar captured the everyday in his underground comics.
I was sort of on a mission with American Splendor, too. I wanted to try to prove that comics could do things. I wanted to expand them beyond superheroes and talking animals.
Remembering Harvey Pekar. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
We have an email from Diane. She writes us from Intervale, New Hampshire, and she writes, would someone please comment on the apparent nexus between BP and the Libyan government regarding the freeing of Lockerbie terrorist? Now, what's behind the story, Nadia? Did BP push for the release of this, the only person convicted in the Lockerbie bombing?
They said they did, and as a lobby, they didn't specifically say it was him, but they were talking about this deal that they have signed with BP of about $900 million to offshore drilling in Libya. And as you know, Libya was opening up to the Western market, and there's so much competition about this oil company of who's going to go there first. And it's been seen that they've been revived from their position in the past after they abandoned their nuclear program, and therefore they've been treated as the good guy. It's a good example, and definitely the previous previous administration under President Bush used it as an example of how you can persuade certain states to give up their program. But saying that, on the other hand, now because BP is a bad guy of what happened in the Gulf Coast after this spill, then the focus is on them. And I think the story came up in the process of did they really push for Abdel Basset el-Megrahi to be released from British jail to be brought back to Libya, and the understanding that he was dying, it was a compassionate act from certain sides to return him. And as it happened, he's still alive and people are very worried.
A year later. Looks pretty good. We see pictures of him on TV.
Yes, and now we've seen also lawmakers in the Congress wanted an investigation to find out exactly how far did PP went and did they specifically ask for the release in return for that. And if this is the case, this is a blood money and need to be looked into further.
Is this just the way things work, Yoki, or is this something remarkable that a company, that these financial interests could be part in the release of this bomber, which caused quite a bit of outrage among Americans?
I mean, in some ways, not to make light of this, because obviously the underlying issue is a tragic one, but, you know, if The Onion or if John Stewart was trying to think, how could a company whose reputation is already as bad as that of BP drive its reputation even lower? It'd be hard to top this. I mean, whether BP specifically lobbied for his release, whether it just more generally lobbied to the British government to do other unspecified actions that could improve a relationship with Libya, I think they found the one way of driving the reputation lower. And it is somewhat remarkable, but it's also an indication of, if you're an oil companies do business in unsavory places. They do business with unsavory people. And oil companies have been linked to human rights abuses. They've been linked to political abuses. They've been linked to, you know, back-channel bribery and arms deals with African dictators. So it's not surprising that they would have a relationship with Libya. It's a little surprising that it might specifically be tied to someone who is connected to one of the worst terror bombings in history.
And a little surprising that then I guess it was the Scottish government, would then go along with the idea of releasing the guy.
Well, I think Yoki makes absolutely the right point. BP makes this a juicy story, gives the scandal new life, if you will. But the real outrage here was that the Scottish government chose to release al-Megrahi, the Libyan intelligence agent. We have to remember 270 people, most of them Americans, died in the Lockerbie bombing. It was a horrific event, and you know, it's bad that BP lobbied, but the real question you should ask is, why on earth did the Scottish government decide to go along?
Can I just add something? I mean, bad as it happened, and I think if one person is killed is good enough for these people to have to be held accountable. But some also raise the fact, and some they were saying that the British victims of the Pan Am plane has kind of allowed him to go back, and they did not have the same resistance as the Americans because they didn't believe he's the one who took the decision, because many people thought he was a scapegoat. The decision was taken on a higher level, and it wasn't him perpetrating the act. He sat there, he planned it, and he went and he executed it, but it was done on a much, much higher level, and he was thrown in as a person to be accountable for the whole thing, and that was part of it. But also, again, all companies in Africa, as Yoga said, in Sudan in particular, I mean, look what they're doing there when we're talking about a genocide of 250,000 people and all companies still working, specifically Chinese.
Let's talk about the situation in Uganda, Yoki. Do we know now who carried out those attacks on World Cup fans last week?
We do. I mean, responsibility was claimed, and from the people I've talked to in the U.S. government, there doesn't appear to be much dispute that it was a group called the Shabab or Al-Shabaab, a terror group that is based in Somalia and has a sort of fascinating history. I mean, they were at one point the kind of armed wing of a government that, for a brief moment in Somalia's recent horrible, bloody history, had moderate elements. Those moderate elements were pushed out, and the government became more and more extreme. That government was in turn pushed out by a current very weak transitional government, which is backed by the U.S. The underlying issue here is that Uganda has troops, as do other African countries, in Somalia as part of a peacekeeping force. Shabab is trying to portray this as a nationalist act, that they're going to push the foreign forces out of Somalia by taking the fight to their soil, in this case, to Ugandan soil.
Could that work, David? Could it make it very hard to get African peacekeepers?
Well, we'll see. What's interesting to me about this is it's right out of the Al-Qaeda playbook. Remember that at a time when Al-Qaeda in Iraq was seeking to push foreign forces that were part of the U.S.-led coalition out of Iraq, there was a very bloody bombing in Spain with the aim of creating political pressure on Spain to withdraw its forces. Spain did end up withdrawing its forces. You can argue about whether that would have happened anyway. But this is pretty classic. It's another sign of the kind of metastasis of Al-Qaeda. We still tend to think of them as concentrated in the tribal areas in Pakistan, but they've slipped out to Yemen. They're increasingly active in Africa, not just in Somalia, but capable of they or their allies, the network of groups linked with them, operating in Uganda, perhaps many other places. So this it's a reminder that this threat and people who operate with the same MO, same tactics, same political aims, are increasingly diffuse throughout the world.
Nadia?
I think Shabab, which is, ironically, it's an Arabic word for the young one or the young men. They have said publicly that actually they did it as a retaliation for the presence of the Ugandan troops. You have Uganda and Burundi now operating as part of the peacekeeping forces in Somalia. The problem now, I think it does have some effect because there is an opposition leader to President Yoweri Museveni of Uganda who said that the consequences of having our military forces outside of our country is bringing us now disasters. And look what happened. And such a tragic attack. And actually, one of my daughter's friend had a friend who was on this restaurant where the attack took place, and 76 people died as a result. And it was all targeted against civilians. But I think in the justification of this jihadist mentality, and I'm no expert on them, but if you see the literature, they don't see any innocent bystanders. And therefore, they see the innocent people, it's a legitimate attack, they go and attack them. And in a way, it's upgrading them to somehow business class. They're no longer doing work in Mogadishu and in Somalia, but they're operating outside. I worked in Africa actually for almost 15 years as a correspondent there, and you can see how easy is it to transfer explosives and the movement of people. It's not difficult to carry an attack, and I'm afraid that we can see more of these attacks happening because it's the logistics is very easy. Now, there is apparently they train on a camp between the Kenyan and the Somali border, and they could be of reach to the U.S. if they wanted to attack them, but some in the intelligence community argue that it will make them of a bigger hero, that now they are upgrade themselves to a list of being not just Al-Qaeda affiliate, but just a group that the U.S. is targeting, and therefore they will recruit more people. The bottom line, and again, I have seen it in Mogadishu 10 years before, is ever since the collapse of the government of Siad Barre till now, there's a vacuum. When there is a vacuum and there is not a strong central government, it's very easy for these groups to operate. And ever since till now, we don't have it. And the Arab countries, by the way, is guilty as well because Somalia is a member of the Arab League. And therefore, they should have been able to solve up this problem. And God knows how many peace negotiations I covered between different factions, Somali groups in Ethiopia and elsewhere. Until now, we have a very weak government, and it's understandable why you have group like a Shabab, and when they carry a horrendous attack of what we have seen in the Ugandan capital the other day, all of a sudden they back into the focus and saying, oh my God, what are we going to do about this Shabab group? They've been existing for a long time, but we ignore them apart because there is a focus is elsewhere.
Yoki?
Yeah, just a very quick point. I mean, what's interesting to me about this attack, what jumped out is that this was indiscriminate civilian casualties watching World Cup, which is enormously popular in the Arab world, it's enormously popular in the Muslim world, it's enormously popular in the jihadi world. Like, the World Cup is sort of the one thing that really truly does bind very disparate cultures. And it comes at a time when many other terror groups have explicitly tried to reduce the number of civilian casualties for fear of losing popular support. Al-Qaeda in Iraq has released papers and sort of diktats to its forces to try to minimize civilian casualties and hit security forces. In Afghanistan, Mullah Omar has done the same. The Taliban have done the same. The Haqqani groups have done the same. So many of these groups have explicitly tried to, in a hearts and minds campaign of a sort, move away from indiscriminate civilian casualties. It's interesting, this group is moving explicitly towards that.
Let's talk to Jason. He's calling us from Utica, Michigan. Jason, thanks for holding on.
Hi, thanks. Greetings, first-time caller. I just want to bring up a question about the Iranian scientist situation that occurred. I've heard the positions, both the Iranian side and the U.S. side, one side saying he was kidnapped, the other side saying he was a willing defector. The one position I have not heard from the U.S. is simply just saying, well, if we're a kidnapper, a terrible kidnapper, why would we just let this person go? You know, if I'm kidnapping somebody and I'm kidnapping somebody of value, I'm smuggling them out of another country, I'm bringing them back, that, you know, they can give me enormous information towards this nuclear situation. Why would I just let this person freely go, and especially without some sort of a swap? It's interesting, too, that the stories of the individual who was involved keep getting more and more diverse. You know, it started out he was kidnapped, he was smuggled out, the Saudis were involved. Then you hear, well, the Israeli agents were involved somehow, too. They were helping out, interrogating. They brought him back. I just can't see a kidnapping of somebody of value just to allow somebody to freely go without any preconditions, just saying, here, yeah, we kidnapped you, we tortured you, we kept you, but here you go. Just go home, and we'll allow that, and it's not an issue anymore. So I just haven't heard the U.S. side say that, and it just seems common sense to me. And
okay.
Then I'll hear your response. Thank you.
Jason, thanks so much for giving us a call. Yoki?
I think it's also very rare that somebody could have the good fortune of being kidnapped and then also paid $5 million. I mean, you know, to use the old Talmudic kind of joke, if that's the thing, I should have that. If that's the bad luck, I should have that same bad luck. I do think that is, the caller is right, that there is a kind of glaring inconsistency in this. I mean, logically, one could think of a case of a person defecting, being paid, giving valuable information, and then, as David pointed out earlier, being homesick, missing their family, feeling lonesome. I mean, there's a human side to these espionage tales that often gets lost in the kind of news coverage of it, which these are human beings who have wives and children and parents and miss them. I mean, in the column this morning, David pointed out that one of the Russians that we have now gotten back had been here and went home and was arrested in Moscow when he returned. As Nadia pointed out, you had Saddam's sons-in-law return, believing that they would be safe and being killed. So there's the human side to this that gets lost. But I think the caller's right that to be kidnapped and paid for $5 million, it doesn't add up.
The answer to the caller, I think, is the bottom line is nobody knows. It's such a mysterious story, and we're just trying to piece it together. I mean, he released three videos that are completely contradicting each other. Saying everything that we have said, I think there is one story that I've read that talks about a possible deal. Don't forget about the hikers that have been held in Iran, these three young people who were hiking alongside the Kurdistan border, and then they were arrested, and they were talking about a deal. Talking about this former FBI agent that also disappeared in Iran. So maybe for the U.S. government, it might be, there is some, who knows? I mean, we don't really know, because you have to be part of the intelligence community to know, but maybe there is actually a deal that whereby we hear later that these hikers will be released.
David, do you think that's possible? Do you hear anything about these hikers? We know that we've heard appeals from their mothers, great efforts on their behalf so far, not to any effect.
The initial response in Iran to the idea that they would be, the hikers would be exchanged, as Amiri came out, was absolutely not. The foreign ministry spokesman explicitly rejected this, saying they're such different kinds of situations. I think the hikers will come out, but not linked to Amiri.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Tom. He's calling us from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Tom.
Hello. I was wondering, concerning the Lockerbie BP connection, I just want to remind everybody, the rest of the world has not forgotten about Lieutenant Colonel Ollie North's cocaine and the Iran-Contra affair, okay? This stuff happens every day. Now, I was wondering, how can we sit and listen to the last 45 minutes of this show, knowing that in the 60s, Rocky and Bullwinkle made fun of a Cold War spy just to help us cope, and here we have comedians making fun of spies walking around the United States for the last 10 years. We got an Iranian who ends up on the other side of the world, and nobody knows how he got there. Can you please give me any reason to believe that we should have confidence in our intelligence system?
You know, Tom, you have covered a lot of ground there. I'm going to turn to David Ignatius.
Well, I just have a smile on my face remembering Natasha Dalek and Moose and Squirrel on the Rocky and Bullwinkle show. You know, that may have had espionage right where it should be. You know, the spy game and what it actually produces in terms of our national security is a really interesting puzzle. We could talk about it for the next day.
Let's talk briefly about the Haitian earthquake. 6 months since the earthquake struck. How are things going there, Yoki?
I mean, if you want to look on the bright side of it, there hasn't been mass starvation. There haven't been epidemics tearing through the refugee camps. That's about it on the sort of bright side of the equation. On the negative side, there's rubble in the streets. There's been no rebuilding. The pledges have not come in. The money that's been promised has not shown up. The world community has been distracted and, as usual, has turned away. So the estimates are roughly 2% of what's been promised and is needed has arrived. The other 98% obviously has not.
Is it going to be on its way? These pledges that were made by the United States and other countries, will they be fulfilled, Nadia?
Actually, the situation is so sad. I was there almost a week after the earthquake, and at the time, and I was on this show again talking about this lack of coordination between different NGOs and how the assistance is not reaching the homeless in the streets of Port-au-Prince. And we're talking about it 6 months later, and the statistics hasn't shown any improvement. You know, as you said, there was $5.3 billion were pledged by so many countries. And funny enough, the biggest were the United States and Venezuela, who pledged their largest amount, like $1.2 billion, and it hasn't come because it's stuck in bureaucracy in the Congress. And also the government in Port-au-Prince. Apparently, the NGOs want to bring their cargoes, and they've been sitting in the ICRC, Save the Children and others. They cannot bring things in, and they wanted to put 20% tax on them.
I'm sorry that we don't have more time to talk about Haiti this morning. It's a story we'll continue to take a look at. I want to thank our panel for being with us this hour. David Ignatius, Nadia Bilbassi, Yoki Driesen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back on Monday. Have a great weekend.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.